For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. Both are ideal for this last week of Black History Month. The first is newly recorded. The second is from the Morning Show archives. Here is part one. For anybody who loves history, and particularly American history, and for anyone who loves to know about someone quite important whose significance is largely forgotten by the general public, I have a wonderful book for you called Boutwell, Radical Republican and Champion of Democracy. This shines a light on a gentleman by the name of George Sewell Boutwell, who actually was quite a significant figure through much of the 19th century. And at one point, the author of this book, Jeffrey Boutwell, calls his great-great-uncle the most consequential public figure Americans have never heard of. And in this book, we hear about the way in which George Sewell Boutwell was significant in Abraham Lincoln's policies during the Civil War, in the struggle to enact and keep in place laws for Reconstruction, and towards the end of the 19th and into the early 20th century, the way in which Mr. Boutwell also stood up against what he saw as imperial impulses by this young, growing nation. And all of this is explored in fascinating fashion in this book. And I'm very excited to speak with Jeffrey Boutwell, a descendant of George Sewell Boutwell, he himself a historian and foreign policy analyst for many years and the author of several different books. Again, this most recent book published by W.W. Norton and Company, Boutwell, Radical Republican and Champion of Democracy. Jeffrey Boutwell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. Wonderful to be here.
I'm excited to talk with you. So I've already touched on the fact that George Sewell Boutwell is someone not nearly as well known as he should be. Tell us your own awareness of this ancestor of yours, and in a sense, your evolving and gradually increasing interest in who he was and what he represented.
Sure, more than happy to. I grew up in the Boston area in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. I have the same last name as George Boutwell. My family grew up, I grew up in Winchester and Concord, Massachusetts. George lived in Groton, Massachusetts, which is only 20, 25 miles away. And yet my family never mentioned that we had this very, very illustrious family member in American politics in the 1800s. George was the youngest ever governor of Massachusetts in the 1850s. Before going on to serve with both Lincoln in the Civil War and then President Grant during Reconstruction. He helped lead the impeachment proceedings against Andrew Johnson, who was a foe of Reconstruction and a foe of civil rights for blacks. And then, as you mentioned, at the end of his life, standing up to Teddy Roosevelt and William McKinley when America sought to annex the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. So very consequential, but my family never mentioned him. I gradually began to learn more about him, Greg, as I got into my 30s and 40s and 50s. But George was largely either ignored or dismissed by American historians for most of the last 100 years. That's why I never saw anything really about him in the history books until the last 20 years, when there began to be new interpretations of the impeachment proceeding against Johnson, of the Reconstruction period, of the Grant administration. And I think that's the best example I can give. Most people will know that up until 20 years ago, Ulysses Grant was considered one of our very worst presidents. He was called a drunkard, corrupt, inept, a political neophyte. And it's only in the last 20 years, with the new biographies by Ron Chernow of Hamilton fame, but many other academics who have rehabilitated Grant's reputation and ergo have rehabilitated the reputation of George Boutwell, who was a close friend and political ally of Grant's for more than 20 years.
Hmm. You tell us that George Sewell Boutwell did leave behind him a sizable memoir, two volumes, titled Reminiscences of 60 Years in Public Affairs. I'm pretty sure you have read that two-volume memoir, but I think you found it less than scintillating, maybe. Or maybe another way to put it is that the impression one gets of George Sewell Boutwell is not necessarily all that positive.
You've really hit the nail on the head, and that's one of the reasons it took me a long time to get into George Boutwell, because, yes, I had read the memoirs 20 and 30 years ago. The writing is often ponderous and stuffy. George is less than charitable to many of his colleagues from that period. He can be a bit smug and a bit condescending to people like Salmon Chase and others that he worked with. And so I kind of said, I'm not sure I really like this guy all that much. And you really have to dive into the memoirs to get the nuggets of his consequential political service, which after a while I did. But yes, there was a feeling at first that, this guy's interesting, but I'm not sure he's worth spending that much time on.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jeffrey Boutwell about his book, Boutwell, Radical Republican and Champion of Democracy. It's the same last name, but this is not a book about the author himself, but rather about his distant ancestor, George Sewell Boutwell. And do I have that right, that he is your great-great-uncle?
Well, genealogists have been incredibly picky with me, and rightfully so. I'm not a direct descendant of George's. George actually has no direct descendants. He had two children, a daughter who never married, a son who married late but had no children. So, one, George has no direct descendants, so I can't claim to be a descendant.
Ah.
And if you can't claim to be a descendant, you can't say that he's your ancestor. An ancestor has to be in the direct line, family line. What I can say is we have a common ancestor going back to the 1700s, the Boutwell family in New England, very much farming families in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. So George is a family member. He actually is a cousin of my great-great-grandfather, a guy named Rodney Cleves Boutwell, who lived in southern New Hampshire. So that's how I'm related to George.
Very good. Thank you for the clarification. So one of the things you tell us about him, and we, I'm afraid, don't really have much time to talk about this, but it's certainly important to acknowledge, is that for someone so significant in American political life for so much of the 19th century, his background was very, very humble, and one would never guess from his origins that he was destined for a life of such wide-reaching significance.
Well, that's precisely, Greg, one of the reasons why he has been neglected and ignored. He came from a farming family. He was self-educated, much like Abraham Lincoln. George never went to school beyond the age of 10 or 11 years old, but he read widely. He, from his parents, Sewell and Sarah, he developed a love of reading, a real intellectual curiosity, just like Lincoln. He'd read till midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning while he was working in a dry goods store as a teenager. Growing up, so very much self-educated, but for that reason, he was very much kind of looked down upon by many of the Boston Brahmin elite, the Whigs of the time, like Henry Adams, and others, Charles Eliot Norton, the Harvard-educated, you know, Brahmin elite, looked their, down their noses at George Boutwell for much of the time. And that carried over into the histories of the 20th century, people like Samuel Eliot Morison and Alan Nevins, who thought, well, this guy's just a country bumpkin, how important can he be? But he shared that with Lincoln in terms of being self-educated, and he shared with Ulysses Grant his very modest upbringing and real appetite for hard work. Grant was modest about his, you know, talents, but when it came to applying himself to the job, there was no one like Ulysses Grant, of course, both in the Civil War and as president, and the same can be said for George Boutwell.
You tell us that his rise to prominence included becoming the youngest ever governor of Massachusetts. And he is part of a increasingly significant wing of the abolitionist movement. Tell us, as at least as well as can be determined so many years after the fact, when it was and how George Boutwell became so fervent in his opposition to slavery.
There's an anecdote that I write about early in the book. At the age of 20 years old, George made his first trip to Washington, D.C. in 1839. During that trip, he meets a black woman who's standing outside of one of the slave pens, so-called slave pens of Washington. Its colloquial name was the Yellow House. And this is where slaves were bought and sold and kept before being sent, quote-unquote, down the river to the Deep South, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, to much harsher conditions on the sugar cane and cotton plantations of the Deep South. George meets this woman whose family has been broken up, and this woman's daughter is being held in the slave pen and is about to be sent down to Louisiana. He never, never, ever forgot that experience, the absolute anguish on this woman's face in talking to her about what the what slavery did to black families and black individuals in our country. So gradually over time, in Massachusetts politics in the 40s and 50s, he became increasingly anti-slavery, such that in the mid-1850s, he was one of the primary founders of the new Republican Party, 1855-56. And then in 1860, he went to the Chicago Convention that helped nominate Abraham Lincoln for president. Hmm.
Again, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but one of the things that I found quite interesting when you talk about his time as Massachusetts governor is that he himself found slavery repugnant, and yet there were certain laws on the books at the time that, in a sense, tied his hands. Things like the Fugitive Slave Act. And so you had Southerners, in a sense, traveling all the way to Massachusetts to retrieve their own slaves, and probably in some cases retrieving blacks who were not their slaves and bringing them back to the South. And there were certain abolitionists who felt like the governor should have even defied these laws in order to stand up to these slave owners. And that was something Mr. Boutwell was not quite willing to do. And actually, that's a picture we see time and time again of a man of principle and integrity who sometimes made difficult decisions that sometimes left him, in a sense, unpopular on both fronts. I mean, really not fully satisfying anybody except his own sense of what was possible and right to do in a given difficult moment.
That very much was George Boutwell. As you say, as governor, he felt he could not go against the federal laws as much as he detested them, the Fugitive Slave Act, because he believed that we are a nation of laws, not of men. The law has to be followed. And in that respect, he considered politics and the Constitution his civil religion, much like Abraham Lincoln did. Lincoln was scrupulous, I can't say 100%, in following the Constitution. Lincoln, yes, during the Civil War, did bend the Constitution in order to win that war, but his attitude then was, well, am I going to not follow one provision of the Constitution but lose the whole thing because we've lost the war to the South? Anyway, George and Lincoln shared this reverence for the Constitution, as a civil religion. And as you say, he took a lot of flack from abolitionists on the left and from conservatives on the right for his positions as governor.
Mm. You write at one point, his commitment to principle, even when it cost him politically, would be a recurring feature of Boutwell's career. We're speaking with Jeffrey Boutwell, talking about his book, Boutwell, Radical Republican and Champion of Democracy. It is a biography of George Sewell Boutwell. During the American Civil War, by this point, Boutwell has risen in prominence to the point, you tell us, that he really helped craft the party platform for the Republican Party for 1860 and helped see to it that Abraham Lincoln, someone he very much admired, was the Republican presidential candidate and, of course, was victorious in that really important election of 1860. Briefly tell our listeners about a couple of the most important roles that Boutwell played, first in the very early days of the war when our nation's capital was under very direct threat, and then a year or two later when he heads up a new facet of the government involved with taxes, again, something of incredibly crucial importance at that point.
Mm-hmm. As you say, in the very early months of the Civil War, when it was not at all certain that Washington would be able to stand a Confederate onslaught from both Virginia, but remember, Maryland was a secessionist-leaning state, so our nation's capital was surrounded by Confederate sympathizers. George was the military liaison between the Massachusetts government and Lincoln's cabinet in Washington. He traveled through very dangerous territory in secessionist Maryland to get to the capital and helped facilitate the delivery of troops and materiel to Lincoln's government so that it could stabilize and then prosecute the war. After that, he became Lincoln's first commissioner of revenue in 1862. To help raise needed funds for the Union Army and the war effort. He did help introduce the very first income tax in America, which had been authorized by Congress to help pay for the war. So when I tell people that I'm a relative of the man who introduced America's first income tax, I ask them not to hold it against me. But it was very important politically at the time to ensure that the North had the resources to win the war. And George, being the progressive that he is, made sure that it was a progressive and a graduated income tax that would tax the wealthy much more than the medium income and lower income folks. Then after that, he became close to Lincoln as they conferred on the appointment of tax assessors. And George played a significant role in prodding Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation in 1862 and 63, which of course set the stage for freeing the slaves, decrying the Confederates of a needed labor source during the war, but also allowing blacks to serve in the Union Army. And ultimately, 200,000 of them did so and were crucially important for a Union victory.
And by the way, this is, a small little detail, but I think it says something about George Sewell Boutwell, that he is in Washington, D.C., just ahead of Lincoln's first inauguration, but he does not remain in Washington and attend the inauguration. He heads back north to Massachusetts. And it kind of flies in the face of what we so often think of as somebody who has influence with the new president, being one of those politicians standing right behind him, sure of being seen by the crowd, and nowadays, of course, seen visible in on the camera lens. And you tell us Mr. Boutwell was actually most comfortable behind the scenes making things happen, not being in the spotlight. In the next section of the book, once, of course, Lincoln is assassinated and he has been succeeded by Andrew Johnson, then Mr. Boutwell becomes increasingly concerned with the measures of Reconstruction being put in place and the ways in which Andrew Johnson stood in their way or seemed to be doing things that would undermine the very measures that were seen by at least some as necessary to knitting the country back together again. And of course, as your book recounts, he helps lead the charge of impeachment, as it were, of course, an effort which ultimately does not lead to Andrew Johnson being removed from office. You tell us that this is one of four major moments in history in which, in a way, George Boutwell was on the wrong side. I mean, in a sense, on the losing side. But that also speaks to his character and the fact that even if something was, in some respects, a losing cause or a difficult task, that doesn't mean he didn't pursue it with all of his energy.
Mm-hmm, very much. I'll make a slight correction to your wording there, Greg. He wasn't on the losing side of history, but he was seen to be on the losing side
of
right.
history. Yes.
By historians 100 years. I would say he was absolutely on the right side of history in all four of those episodes, the impeachment of Johnson, Reconstruction, his allegiance to Ulysses Grant, and finally the anti-imperialist campaign.
Right. Very good. One of the things you tell us is that Mr. Boutwell was responsible for, among other things, the enactment of certain really important legislation. And because I just interviewed an author about a book concerning white supremacy in modern-day America, I think that's one of the reasons why this leapt out at me, a very important moment when Boutwell helps see to the passage of something that was known sort of in shorthand as the Ku Klux Klan Act, more officially the Third Enforcement Act. But, I mean, he was relentless in his concern for the safety and well-being of Southern blacks. And it seems to me this is one of the most inspiring things about him and his career.
There's almost no other public figure from the 1850s up until the end of Reconstruction in 1877 who remained steadfastly committed to the concepts of black equality, black suffrage, giving the newly freed 4 million slaves in the South a chance to become full American citizens. Other Republicans kind of started out strong, but then fell by the wayside. I'm thinking of Carl Schurz from Wisconsin, Horace Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune. They were very much in favor of, you know, black rights in the 50s and 60s, but by the 70s, they'd grown tired of it, like most of America had, and George Boutwell was one of the few, along with Ulysses Grant, who remained totally committed to that up and through the end of Reconstruction.
It was interesting. I don't know that I remember seeing before the term Reconstruction fatigue, which I think is exactly what you are describing, but that is something to which George Sewell Boutwell never succumbed. Briefly explain the role that he played in helping to craft what became the 14th and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution.
In 1865, George was appointed to one of the most important congressional committees ever created, the Joint Committee on Reconstruction. And that was the committee responsible for crafting the 1866 Civil Rights Act, then the 14th Amendment, and later the 15th Amendment. And given George's, he had a wonderful talent for putting words on paper in terms of legislation and things like that. You know, look back at his role in the 1860 party platform. So he was one of the primary drafters of the 14th and 15th Amendments that sought to preserve, you know, equality for blacks. Now, you mentioned Reconstruction fatigue. You know, there was a lot of support in the 1860s, but imagine you're in America in 1876. The war's been over for 11 years. Your country's about to celebrate its 100th anniversary in 1876. Many northern whites were just tired of being told that they had to keep striving and keep pushing to protect black rights. They just wanted to get back to earning a living and making money and, you know, promoting American well-being. And that was what Reconstruction fatigue was all about. And it took people like Boutwell and Grant to try and swim against the tide and say, no, our revolution isn't finished. We need to establish a multiracial democracy in America, and that will only happen if we make sure we have ironclad protections for our newly minted black citizens.
The final portion of your book is when George Sewell Boutwell, in a sense, maybe resurges in importance maybe it's in a sense sort of a last hurrah. He probably would not have wanted it characterized that way. But he rises up in opposition to what he sees as imperial attitudes with the United States around and in the wake of the Spanish-American War. And he actually ends up, I would assume, helping to create or at least serving as president of something called the Anti-Imperial League. Explain what this group was all about and why this issue was of such great concern to George Sewell Boutwell.
Mm-hmm. Anti-Imperialist League was America's first mass public movement opposing American adventurism overseas. McKinley and Roosevelt wanted to physically annex the Philippines, take control of that country, and for George Boutwell, that meant denying them their own chance at independence and denying them their basic civil rights as enshrined in our Constitution. He felt that our Constitution should apply to anyone that we had control over overseas as well as in our own country. And what we were doing in the Philippines, George felt, was no different than what we had done in the South in depriving blacks of their civil rights in the South. So that's why he considered the annexation of the Philippines such an incredibly important issue. Mm.
You mention at one point that George Sewell Boutwell engaged in 7 decades of public service, beginning during the term of Martin Van Buren and passing away during the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt. And if you know anything about American history, from Van Buren to Roosevelt, that is a huge span of time and a huge span of growth and change. And it's just fascinating to think about, just by looking at his life, how much we learn about America and how it really ascended and transformed itself in so many ways during his lifetime.
Very much. America became what it is today from the presidency of Van Buren through the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt. And one of the gratifying things that people have told me who've read the book is that, you know, it's not just a fascinating biography of George Boutwell. It really is an encapsulation of American history as to what we were to become and what we have become today. 7 decades of American history that George was part of really did lead to where America is today.
The book, again, is Boutwell, Radical Republican and Champion of Democracy, telling the story of George Sewell Boutwell. The book is published by W.W. Norton & Company, the author Jeffrey Boutwell. Jeffrey Boutwell, thank you so much for writing this fascinating and important book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. It was great to speak with you.
Enjoyed it, Greg. Thanks very much.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part 2 of today's program is an interview from the Morning Show archives, recorded and initially broadcast back in 2009. It is certainly a pleasure and an honor for me to be speaking for the next few minutes with one of our country's premier scholars and lecturers on the topic of African American culture. His name is Howard Dotson, who has been director of the prestigious Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture for more than 2 decades. His writing has appeared in many, many different places, and he writes with exceptional discernment about the complexity of the African-American experience through its history and in modern culture. And he has a new book to his credit, which is called Becoming American, The African-American Journey. It is published by Sterling. And Howard Dotson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, sir.
I'm really glad to be talking with you about this really fascinating book. It is put together in such a unique fashion, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you came up with the idea of combining some very interesting elements together in order to try to give us a picture of African-American history.
The publisher, Sterling Press, came to us. They have a series they've been doing on what they call a pocketbook, histories of a variety of countries, and they asked if I would consider doing one on the African American experience. And we looked at some of the works that they had done previously and thought that it was something that we could, in fact, do, but we weren't sure that we could get it all into their pocketbook format. So we ended up expanding the format a little bit and adding some things that were not in some of the earlier books, but finding a way of presenting the African-American experience in a unique kind of presentation. It's a chronology, first of all, but a chronology of the African-American experience in the United States set in the context of both the unfolding of human history. Our goal there was to connect the African-American experience to the total history of humankind, including the history of Africa, rather than just truncated as an extension of the transatlantic slave trade, which it was not. And then the second is to place the African-American experience in the context of the global black experience, the experiences of people of African descent on the African continent, in Europe, in South and Central and America, in the Caribbean, and in other parts of the world, and to give people an opportunity to see the complexity and diversity, the depth and reach of the African American and African diasporan presence in human history. That's what we've attempted to do, and we've tried especially to show through the African American narrative the ways in which African-American history is, in fact, American history, and to provide some insights into the ways in which black people of all classes and of all political and cultural and other persuasions have been part of the making of this thing we call America. Hmm. And I think that a quick read through the book will give you some hints in that direction.
What's particularly intriguing, of course, is that at some point, once there are Africans who have been brought to North America, we have these two chronologies side by side, African American, mm-hmm. and then what you call the global African diasporan. And it is fascinating because even at a glance, even before we read and take in any of the specific content in these detailed chronologies, we realize that for almost all of us who live in modern America, we never think of African American history in this way, as being mm-hmm. this complicated a story or this long a story.
Yes, we unfortunately, and perhaps Black History Month is partially to blame for that. We started focusing on the heroes and heroines of African American experience, and so when people say black history, they start thinking about Frederick Douglass and W.B. Du Bois and Harriet Tubman and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, et cetera. About 25 or 30, I call my super heroes and sheroes of the African-American experience. But history is not something that's made by elites. It's made by ordinary people, grandfathers and grandmothers and great-grandfathers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers of ordinary African-American people who, through struggle and through sacrifice and through hard work, have both transformed themselves and transformed this society. And what we've wanted to try to show in the American part of the book, at least, is that African-American history is American history, and that American history without African-American history is at minimum partial, and it's likely untrue in many instances.
It brings to mind a really interesting and ultimately really troubling story with which you begin your introduction, in which you talk about your studies in history and sociology and so on, all the way through a master's degree, and of what was starkly missing from your studies until, I think you said, the second year of your master's degree program. Tell us about that.
Well, I went through grade school, junior high school and high school, and undergraduate school without ever having a course in dealing with black people. And at the graduate school level, it was my second year of my master's program that I had my first course dealing with black people, of any black people at all, and it was specifically about the changing political situation in Africa that was taking place as Africa was decolonizing. But up to that point in time, no courses specifically focused on the African-American experience. And what little I learned in the segregated schools from teachers who wanted to at least introduce us to some of the heroes and heroines of the African-American experience, the people that I mentioned before. And unfortunately, black history has been largely limited at the teaching level to celebrating those individuals until fairly recently. We're getting a lot more content in the books now, and a lot more material is available, and we hope that this little book that we've put together will serve as a catalyst and an introduction to people who want to know, or either want or need to know, more about the African-American experience as a part of the American experience.
And to extend black history beyond what you call black biography. I mean, what you were describing before is too often true to too many people, that all they know about African-American history is perhaps something of the story of a few luminaries. And you're saying
that's correct.
The historical story is far richer than that and needs to be told.
It's far richer than that and so deeply embedded in the American story that all Americans need to learn more about it. You probably won't know very much about American history if you don't know something more than we know currently about the African-American experience. So this is just a contribution to that that effort.
One thing that is intriguing in this chronology is for us to, which by the way begins, we should tell our listeners, begins 4 million years before Christ. It's interesting to see the first mention of slavery in that chronology. And the first references to slavery actually have nothing to do with the continent of Africa or Africans
Absolutely.
Being enslaved, slavery already being present in Europe. And then, of course, eventually those tentacles extend to the African continent. But the story of slavery does not begin with Africa.
It does not begin with Africa, and it does not begin with African Americans. And all human societies practiced slavery at some time. Even the great Egyptian society was a slavery-based society. And there were enslaved peoples in the many of the Asian societies, in the of course, in the European societies. The word slave actually comes from Slavs, who were whites who were enslaved at an early period in European history. So the slavery experience is not something that's uniquely African-American or African, but all too frequently it's been presented as though that was in fact the case, when the transatlantic slave trade comes very, very late in the history of slavery. And what's unique about it is that it's the first time that in a significant way there's a global revulsion against it as an institution. And that is an important marker in the history of all of humankind.
In other words, before that, slavery was to an amazing extent sort of accepted as some
normal.
Sort of norm. I mean, we think of it as a twisted norm, if a norm at all, but somehow it never ultimately took permanent root here the way it had elsewhere, although it was a long struggle to remove it.
That is absolutely correct.
I was surprised in the African American chronology to see the first mention of enslaved Africans in North America in 1526. I did not realize.
This always surprises people, and it's a very interesting fact. Because most of our, even the African-American history books until very, very recently, said the first Africans arrived in the United States in 1619 in Jamestown. Those were the first to arrive in a British colony. But the earlier immigrants were actually coming during the period of Spanish colonization in North America. And the first group actually come to the area around Georgia, South Carolina, in 1526 as part of a Spanish expedition that brought enslaved Africans to the United States to create settlements there. The good news is that within a few months, that group of about 300 enslaved Africans revolted and ran off and settled among the Native American population.
Hmm. I was amazed, actually, that this chronology could have as much detail as it does. First of all, that much of this chronology dates back to very ancient history and, in a sense, prehistory of the very first entries. But also, even that once the historical record is kept, that nonetheless, that it is possible for us to know so much about the distant past when it comes to this African-American history, as you describe it.
Well, the good news is that over the last 30 to 40 years, people in the academy who had not paid very much attention to the African-American or African experience have taken it seriously. Over 100 African-American studies programs have been established throughout the United States, the colleges and universities. Textbooks have been rewritten, et cetera. And so there's a lot more available now than was available previously, and a lot more that we have to sink our teeth into. And it's a lot to digest. It's an awful lot to digest, but the good news is that it kind of snaps us out of our myopia and really narrow thinking about this experience and challenges us to open our minds and hearts and our intelligence to learn a lot more about a very, very complex experience. I mean, one of the things that we miss in the telling of the African-American experience, the individuals who came from Africa to the United States were very, very diverse people from different religious and national backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds. They come to the United States as much strangers to themselves as they are to their European captors. And yet in the midst of slavery, they transform themselves into new people, new African-American people, both here in the United States and throughout the Americas. A blending, melding of their African diversity with the Native American and European diversity they encounter on these shores. So the African-American population is one of the most complex populations in the world, and I would argue it may be the most American population in the United States, because all of America's people at one level or another are part of the, if you will, DNA of African Americans. And we do ourselves an injustice by treating it as something, you know, as simply as we've been treating it in the past. And there's so much to be learned from us about our collective selves as Americans through the study of the African-American experience. Hmm.
We should mention that part two of your book is an interesting collection of various documents, several famous speeches, all springing out of this history. And it's fascinating, for instance, to realize when you pick up a book like this that probably the vast majority of us have never read the Emancipation Proclamation. I know I never had, not in its entirety. And I wonder what you were imagining the importance would be in including every single word of a document like that in this book.
Well, the Emancipation Proclamation is a very interesting document. It actually has been given more credit than it actually probably deserves. But in the minds of people, it was a source of inspiration well beyond its actual text. And people heard that that slavery had been abolished and took it upon themselves to abolish it themselves by running away and leaving it, even though in many instances the Emancipation Proclamation only freed the enslaved population in the states that were in rebellion against the United States, which is the Southern, the Confederate states. And those states that where slavery still existed within the Union, it did not abolish slavery at all. Hmm. But people have taken it to mean that it it ended slavery completely. That didn't happen until the 13th Amendment was passed in 1865. But we thought it important to put that kind of document, to put the amendments to the Constitution that were passed that granted people, black people, the right to citizenship and the right to vote and their civil rights, et cetera, to put those as part of our legal right to citizenship in the United States. We also included the Declaration of Independence, which in my mind is the, if you will, the founding creed of America that is endorses the notion of human equality and the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and justice for all people. That kind of founding creed is what really what I believe we should measure our achievements as Americans against. And we still, in my mind, the title suggests Becoming American is, yes, about the African-American journey to citizenship, but it's also about America itself as an unfinished project, one that we're still working to make real for all Americans. And I'm just very excited about that that kind of perspective on where we are, especially in this era of Mr. Obama's presidency, as he's called us to take up the challenge of making America anew, and making it, I think, within the framework of this founding doctrine, founding creed.
I think it must be amazing to you to be able to write this chronology of African American history and have as the last entry Barack Obama is elected the 44th president of the United States. I mean, I assume that 5 years ago, 3 years ago, even a year ago, you might not have imagined such a thing to be possible. I mean, at least at this moment in time, and yet here it is.
Well, I had worked previously in the two Jesse Jackson campaigns, and all of us worked assiduously to try to get him as many electoral votes, et cetera, as we could. But all of us did so knowing that he was not going to be the Democratic Party nominee. And I'd say that most of us, including myself, frankly never believed that we would live to see the day when an African American would be elected president of the United States. So this is an incredible moment in my own personal history, but I think in the history of all African Americans and in the history of America, because it turns a corner in the African Americans' relationship to America, especially as they've sought to affirm their rights as citizens. Electing him president comes as close as you can come to saying, finally, that African Americans are full citizens of this nation.
Hmm. The book again is Becoming American: The African American Journey. Howard Dotson, the author. The book published by Sterling. Howard Dotson, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, and the book is only $12.95. Everybody can have a copy.
The preceding Morning Show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2009. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I will be welcoming into our studios Wisconsin State Representative Robert Wittke. We'll talk about a number of issues, but in particular, the state budget recently proposed by Governor Tony Evers. On Wednesday, we'll be joined by Carolyn Frisch, Chief Executive Officer of the United Way of Kenosha County, and several other guests talking about a new collaboration between the United Way and the University of Wisconsin Parkside's community-based learning program. That's on Wednesday. On Thursday, you'll hear a conversation about the current theatrical production at Carthage, Life is But a Dream, a great masterwork by Spanish playwright Pedro Calderon de la Barca. And on Friday, to finish out Black History Month, Richard Rothstein and his very important book, Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And don't forget to seek out the podcast version of The Morning Show to hear a different Morning Show 7 days a week. Today's going to be partly sunny and mild, a high of 51 degrees with fairly brisk southwesterly winds. Tonight, cloudy with a 30% chance of rain and a low of 32 degrees. Tuesday, sunny and mild, a high of 49 degrees. Wednesday, mild as well, but with cloudy skies and rain likely. Again, a high of 49 degrees. Partly sunny skies then expected for the remainder of the week and into the weekend. Mild temperatures to continue. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elk.